Thank you, thank you. I'm Ken, this is John, and you're going to see videos later on John's creations. The Pulitzer's great, but more importantly, I wanted to say that when I was a young boy in the 1960s, I was a brilliant fisherman. My dad and I would launch our 18-foot boat into the harbor at Newport Beach, and we'd motor along the coast, and I caught a lot of fish. Really big fish. Tons of fish. Okay, maybe that isn't me in those photos, but it's true that my dad and I caught so many yellowtail and rockfish and bonito and barracuda that my little hands would cramp up, and I couldn't lift the burlap sack of fish at the end of a morning, and our freezer was just stuffed with fish. And by the time I was a teenager, I seemed to lose my touch. And as a young man in the 1980s, I just had rotten luck. Fishing wasn't fun anymore. If there were fish out there, I couldn't catch them. And I stopped, and I really didn't understand what was going on until about 5 years ago, when I took on a new beat at the LA Times covering the coasts and the oceans. And I started going to scientific conferences to immerse myself in the topics, and what I saw basically horrified me. And scientists like to measure changes, and the results of what they were meticulously tracking all looked like waterfalls. In fact, a lot of them call them waterfall charts, and they pretty much look all the same. The population of fish plummeted from the 50s and 60s to the 80s. And it wasn't just fish, but marine habitats seemed to be in decline. Your basic kelp forests that we find off here, they're making way for urchin barrens. Coral reefs are overgrown by bacteria and algae. And this reef here in Jamaica's Discovery Bay was once one of the most beautiful and best-studied coral reefs in the world 26 years ago, and this is what it looks like today. The thing is that we're amazingly adaptable species. Things change, and we adapt. And we forget how things once were, especially with the oceans. And if you can't see the problems as you sip your drink, you know, in an ocean restaurant, everything seems pretty much okay. But the ocean surface provides a convenient cover. For most of human civilization, we've thought the oceans were simply too vast to change. We thought their bounty of seafood inexhaustible, and their ability to absorb pollution infinite. And we haven't really given this much thought until recently. So we've been treating the oceans pretty much as if they had an endless capacity to be both a refrigerator and a toilet, something that you wouldn't confuse in your own home. I've found still, despite these changes, over the past half a dozen years, that stories that focus on the oceans in trouble are a tough sell. And in my view, too many people outside the news business give too much credit to the media, us troglodytes in the mainstream media, for setting the agenda or controlling it in some conspiratorial way. But most of the time, what we do is reflect society rather than direct it. Sure, we give readers what we think is important news, but we also work hard to give them what we think they want. So let me give you just a brief peek inside the newsroom. You know, in my world, I have to go pitch a story to an editor. And editors are pretty good surrogates for the public, except they've got shorter attention spans and they're much crankier. There's a tremendous competition for space in the newspaper, just as there is in the minds of the busy public. So when I'm waving some new inch-thick report around over the infighting, over setting limits, over bacteria in coastal waters, you know, with the awful name, courtesy of the U.S. government, Total Maximum Daily Load, or worse, the acronym, TMDL, this is what I'm up against. We've got explosions in the Middle East, the Iraq War, terrorism, wacky court fights, and in Los Angeles, which is movie town, even the latest celebrity to get pulled over for drunk driving can bump me off the front page. How do we compete with that? Not very well. So I spent a lot of time strategizing, trying to figure out a way to grab the attention of our top editors. They are the gatekeepers of the front page. And just like our readers, they're overwhelmed with too much to do, too much information, too many distractions. So the Altered Ocean series was an unusual undertaking for a newspaper. There were no headline-grabbing calamitous events. There wasn't a hurricane or a tsunami. There was not a massive human deaths, nor was there an easy or convenient villain. No chemical company illegally dumping waste, or corrupt official, or bulky government agency. Instead, what I was trying to go after was something that I think of as sort of a three strikes against a newspaper story. One, I was interested in taking a hard look at the slow creep of environmental decay, the kind of changes that have taken place so slowly that most of us don't even notice, with the exception of scientists who are out there carefully measuring everything. Second, I wanted to do it in a watery realm where few people go. And third, I wanted to look at the global environmental declines that come at the hands of human industrial society. And that means the uncomfortable notion of holding up the mirror and saying, it's not one corporate bad actor, but it's really all of us. We're all responsible for this. As you might imagine, it took months for me to persuade my editors to go for this, and I was lucky at the time to have a very courageous top editor named Dean Baquet, who gave me the green light. And for those of you who followed the troubled story of the LA Times and the newspaper industry in general, Dean was dismissed along with our publisher last year for standing up to our corporate bosses. They were pressing for more layoffs, and he and our publisher were saying, we can't cut our way into the future. So I had a commitment of time and space in the paper, but wanted to make it a compelling read. And too many environmental stories, in my opinion, you know, are about future or conditional threats. And that helps them lose out to stories about things that are happening in the moment. And it also subjects them to criticism and the sort of sky is falling mockery that we get by paid lobbyists and professional contrarians. So to give the Altered Ocean Project some currency, we had to go beyond the forecasts of scientists, all the notes I took at scientific meetings, all the interviews and the six heaping file drawers of scientific papers that I managed to slog through. So we went out to places where human detritus and the rise of slime are affecting wildlife and people's lives or livelihoods now. The way to tell the story was not to tell it at all, but to show it. And so we focused on the stresses on the sea and, more importantly, the blowback that's coming on shore. If we can switch over to the video input, please. Tipping point, yeah.
Jeremy Jackson is back in Discovery Bay. 26 years ago, a hurricane ripped through these waters, turning the staghorn corals into mounds of rubble. Jackson and other scientists inspected the damage and predicted the corals would rebound quickly, just as they always have.
You know, we were the best and the brightest, and we got it wrong, totally, completely wrong.
The scientists didn't factor in the additional stresses of overfishing and nutrient loading. As a result, Jackson spends most of his homecoming dive picking the weeds that have taken over his reef.
All of those elkhorn forests are gone, and all of those staghorn forests are gone. Of course, what's most striking is that the forests of corals have been replaced by forests of seaweeds.
What's happening here is another example of slow environmental decay sliding into a self-perpetuating collapse. The results are fundamental changes to the ocean. By taking everything we want out of the ocean and dumping in what we don't want, Jackson says we are changing its contents, composition, and chemistry.
This is a time of very great change. It's a time of great opportunity and a time of great risk because things are really, I think most of us believe, at a kind of tipping point.
Jackson says we're pushing the oceans back to the dawn of evolution when bacteria and jellyfish ruled. It's a trend he calls the rise of slime.
I can imagine an ocean that would be a continuous dead zone along all the coasts. People won't want to live in places like Malibu. They'll want to live in places like Kansas or South Dakota to be away from the ocean instead of next to it.
Remove enough fish or add enough nutrients, and what was once a coral reef turns into a weed field. A kelp forest becomes an urchin barren. Walking on a sandy beach becomes a slog through drifts of seaweed.
That was the lead video on day one of the series, and we produced 10 of those in all. Now, 5 years ago, Altered Oceans on LATimes.com would have been a series of links to the stories, a photo gallery, maybe a PDF of that TMDL report that Ken mentioned, and if we were lucky, maybe a very short video introduction from Ken himself. Because in all likelihood, the multimedia team would not have even have known about this project until the day before it published. But that's all different now. Ken is an early convert. There was 4 years ago when he came to us with a little bit of footage that he and a photographer had shot back from British Columbia on aquaculture and salmon farming up there. And as a result of that video, I gained a whole new understanding of what farm fresh salmon really meant and what produced that wonderful red color that you find in salmon. I've never been able to eat salmon since. So that's the beginning of a collaboration that Ken and I have developed over the years. It led to this. He brought us in on the ground floor, and I'm very much appreciative for it. He knew it was going to add a great deal of time and expense to the project, but he also saw the benefits. Now, video produced by newspapers will always be different from what's produced by broadcast journalists because we are rich in content. Every one of the video reports is the tip of the iceberg of research on that topic. And you don't always get that on TV because there's no time for the reporter to master the material. So you get a series of talking heads that never gets past the surface. But we are still in a YouTube world where you have seconds to grab the viewer's attention. In fact, my boss's dictate to me was, John, you can tell as many stories as you want. They can't be over 2 minutes. So the whole time, you know, that was what was in my mind the whole time, was to how can I convey this message? How can I can get this complex subject across in 2 minutes or less? So the same criteria that Ken applied to his writing in grabbing the viewer's attention and doing the show and not the tell, I also did that for my videos. Now, the other thing that distinguishes video produced by a newspaper, and specifically the Times, is having our still photographers shoot video. They have the access, they have the instinct, and a photojournalist's very unique way of framing a picture, and that's what differentiates our video production. So with a still camera on one shoulder and a video camera on the other, Rick Loomis did the show and not the tell. And in the end, I had over 120 hours of footage. And the end result was 12 minutes of video. Back to you.
I'm up.
You're up.
All right. Well, so Rick Loomis and I, over the course of about a year, we dove with scientists who measured the load of nitrogen pollution and phosphorus spewing into the ocean. And this outfall you see is off Hollywood, Florida, and it meets all state and federal laws for secondary treatment, which is the state of the art. It's amazing how much comes out of that. We scrutinize snot balls that are popping up in the Florida Keys and elsewhere, and they're a gooey mixture of bacteria and algae, and the Adriatic Sea, they get pretty big, as you can see. We went out with Georgia fishermen who can make more money catching jellyfish than shrimp. And the reason is that jellies are running so thick and the shrimp are so scarce. We went to Moreton Bay, Australia, which has an amazing amount of slime, including a very toxic cyanobacterium that looks like a dark green or black weed and smothers the seafloor, and it causes fishermen to break out in rashes all over their bodies. It also promotes the growth of tumors in turtles. And I spent time with a family who thought they had moved to paradise on just a lovely barrier island on the west coast of Florida. But it turns out the paradise is making their 10-year-old sick. There's a very toxic algae, they call a red tide down there, that stains the ocean sort of a deep purple-red bruise, and it sends toxins ashore on the sea breeze. It also litters the shores with dead manatees and fish and turtles and all sorts of other things. We also focused on the persistence of plastics in marine debris and followed the trash that races off the city streets in LA and down the Los Angeles River. We followed this debris that swirls around in huge gyres off in the Pacific. Scientists call these garbage patches, and the one off our coast is about twice the size of Texas. To get a sense of this, we went to Midway Atoll, one of the Northwest Hawaiian islands, known as a major seabird rookery, and for the trash that washes ashore. and how some birds, such as the albatross parents, pick up bits and pieces of this plastic from the ocean's surface. They mistake it as food and regurgitate it, feeding it to their chicks. And the result is about, of the 200,000 albatross chicks that die here every year, have twice as much plastic in their bellies as healthy chicks. If we can switch back to the next video.
Midway Atoll. It's one of the most geographically remote places in the world, but there's plenty of activity. This speck in the middle of the Pacific is a major rookery for seabirds such as petrels, terns, and especially the Laysan albatross. Each year, 500,000 albatross chicks are born here. They spend their first 6 months on land, and they are entirely dependent on what the parents find foraging at sea. A slurry of fish eggs and squid is typical. So is the plastic.
And here we got a couple customers.
Brian Peterson is a paramedic assigned to the atoll.
And we don't have a lot of business as far as island personnel. So we do other things to keep ourselves busy. And one of the things is picking up dead birds. And we've just collected probably about 50 birds this morning. We'll just leave them here, and then they'll get either burned or covered up a little bit later today.
Two out of every five chicks born will die before they lose that downy fuzz. Dehydration and starvation. The sheer volume of the plastic doesn't leave room for food and liquid.
Okay, I'm opening up the stomach now.
Wildlife biologist John Clavitter.
We oftentimes find lighters in here, little light bulbs, toothbrushes, anything that floats that basically an albatross can eat, they'll have in their stomachs.
The North Pacific subtropical gyre is a clockwise swirl of plastic debris. Some of the trash gets hung up for decades before it spins out into different currents, or is picked up by an animal, or ends up on an island beach. Tons and tons of marine trash, and about four-fifths of it comes from land, swept out of coastal cities and into the sea.
Unfortunately, you know, over time, plastics will probably become more and more prevalent in our oceans. So I hate to be pessimistic, but I'm sure the problem will become worse before it becomes better.
I love those albatross. They're really something. Can we switch back to the PowerPoint, please? It's on?
Yes.
We also spent a lot of time on the along the California coast, including at marine mammal rehab centers. And as you may have read in the last couple days, they're overrun every spring by sick and dying sea lions and seals and dolphins. And many are suffering from eating anchovies contaminated by toxic algae. It's really insidious stuff. It damages their brain and destroys their memory. It even causes mother sea lions to turn on their pups when they try to suckle. At a marine mammal care center in San Pedro, a veterinarian found a pup ripped to pieces by its mother, and the veterinarian suspects that the mother, simply poisoned into delusion, had forgotten that it had given birth. The idea here generally was to show the public that things aren't going perhaps the way nature had intended. If we can switch back one more time, one last.
Neuschwander, the sea lion, keeps getting lost. And the staff at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito thinks they know why. She was first discovered comatose under a pier in Avila Beach. Treated and released, she was found a week later far from the ocean in Sacramento. A new type of toxic algae has emerged on the west coast that produces domoic acid. And as it works its way up the food chain, the neurotoxin is causing mass die-offs of marine mammals. It also damages the brain's frontal lobe. And that's why veterinarian Francis Gulland has brought Neuschwander to Raytel Medical Imaging in San Francisco. An MRI will reveal just how much damage this neurotoxin has done. Brain scans confirm her suspicions.
Us non-neuroradiologists think she's got a little hippocampus. We're becoming experts.
Domoic acid causes nerve cells in the hippocampus to continuously fire impulses until they burn out and die. It's a cascading effect that produces seizures and abnormal behavior. Sea lions and other marine mammals are often referred to as the sentinels of ocean and human health. The sentinels are telling us something is wrong in the ocean. In the last decade, marine mammal stranding spiked along with the number of harmful algae blooms in coastal waters. Since 1998, the five marine mammal rehabilitation centers in California have been overwhelmed with cases of neurotoxin poisonings. And it's forcing people like Gulland to make decisions about which patients can be saved and which ones can't. The prognosis doesn't look good.
I mean, I'm convinced that she looks terrible, but, and she's already gone up to Sacramento once.
Right.
Like, how much do you make her go through? I think the sensible thing to do is to use an iodine.
I'm okay with it. It makes sense too. To me.
I mean, that's how we do it, right?
Right.
Okay.
15 cc's of sodium pentobarbitone and Neuschwander's suffering is over. One last exhale. And the sea lion's heart flutters and stops. Another victim, another warning sign that something in our oceans has gone grievously wrong.
In one of the early story meetings, Ken and the editors were all talking about, and I thought they were saying demonic acid, and I thought, well, this has got to be some bad stuff. Then I found out it was actually domoic acid, and the more I learned about it, I realized, yeah, it is really bad stuff. Then as I stood there, you know, a couple of feet away from Neuschwander, and his last breath kind of washed over me, I thought in the journalist's perverted way, I got the story, finally. Now I can start to share how insidious this stuff is and how terrible it is. This is what I'm up against all the time. This is what all journalists are up against, is how to convey these very complex subjects in a very simple way. And the reason I was standing there is because Ken had worked for a very long time to establish that relationship with Frances. We were waiting for that moment when she would give us the call and say, you know what, I'm going into San Francisco, we're going to take another sea lion in and give him an MRI, can you be here? We were there, we have that moment, and that's something that, you know, print reporters and good documentarians, you know, specialize in. They take the time to listen and to work those sources and to create those relationships, and that's the kind of payoff that we get. I was fortunate enough to be the videographer on that one. I also wrote all the scripts based on Ken's very long, very well-written stories. I was able to poach some really key sentences from him, and some of the reporting was actually kind of paraphrased and based on what I had seen as well. But what we did was, what we had to do all along was just to adapt those 100-inch stories, those 5 days and all those sidebars, and make it ready for the website. So what keeps me awake at night? Questions like, how big can we make the video window? Are they Windows, QuickTime, or Flash format? How big can we make the photo galleries? Where do we put the captions? Where do we how do we make the new elements live over 5 days? You know, who's moderating the message board? Now, these are all considered, debated, and compromised on. And the final product has some very elegant features and some very clunky ones. And that just means we're still trying to figure out how to do this thing called multimedia journalism. But newspapers are well positioned to compete in the new media world. We've got the content, the in-depth reporting, and the analysis that goes beyond the eyeball-grabbing video clip by also telling us what it means. Thank you very much.
Well, it's really great to have you here. And just quickly for the audience, Andy Revkin, I think, has provided the best coverage, in my opinion, of the issue of global warming. He's been covering it for a long time, I think back into the 80s. He has, I think, the broadest perspective, And I think his writing is in many ways the most insightful and the most in-depth. And I thought it would be very interesting to interview him about it. He's actually done one or two interviews with me, and usually he interviews scientists, but I thought it would be interesting to kind of get his perspective. So I'll start, Andy, with a very broad question, and that is, you have seen the coverage of global warming evolve. I mean, it's obviously almost, you know, some people might say it's almost reached a fervor in terms of the number of times we see it in the paper. Can you just give us your perspective on how it's evolved over the time you've covered this issue?
Sure. There was only one other time when the coverage really peaked in a big way in my experience, and that was the summer of 1988 when we had Yellowstone had a big, huge fire. We had record heat, drought, and the Amazon was on fire. That was the year of the Amazon burning, becoming a big story. And so back then, it was all kind of tropical heat and record summer heat here, and that all kind of conspired to create a news story for the first time around climate. In the Times, we'd written already a lot about the basic science, but that was the first time it really was a news story. And then Jim Hansen testified in the Senate, and that really kind of peaked it as well. And then things went away. Oil prices through the 90s were fairly low. The economy was kind of in overdrive. We had the Desert Storm to think about, and the only real blip in there was Kyoto, the Kyoto Treaty. But I don't know if anyone saw Frontline last week, that it did a good job of showing that it's not just the Bush administration that hasn't acted politically on the climate problem. This was the same through the Clinton years as well. And right now, sort of observing this burst recently, I have one of these Google, several different sort of automated web sifting things that send me clips as they're happening. And I get, you know, over 100 routinely a day of those now, and that was never the case a couple of years ago. Now, and the things that have fed it, I think a couple of them are obvious, you know, the Gore movie, Hurricane Katrina, but a couple are maybe a little less obvious, one being high oil prices, which really kind of were right around that same time, Katrina and Inconvenient Truth kind of coming down the pike. And those things together, along with a lot of news out of the Arctic, include being stuff I've been writing. So the tropics burning kind of went away as the iconic image of this. And it became more melting instead of burning. And that's where we're at now. So that's all. Oh, and then you had the IPCC report. And the one last element was Jim Hansen. The politics of the story have often been the thing that have driven it onto the front pages of newspapers.
And we saw that here.
And I wrote about that.
We saw that here. We had Jim Hansen. He was the first speaker in the series we're doing. And, I mean, he drew, I mean, we were turning, we I think we sat 1,500 people but turned away the rest. And just, I think the fact that the story you had written, I think you broke that story about his most recent flap with this Bush's administration. And, that certainly, he's almost become an icon in the whole global warming debate. Do you have... You know, is there anything you can tell us a little bit about that, how you broke that story?
It was basically a conversation with Jim the very beginning of that year, 2006, on the telephone and in his wonderful, understated Iowa farm boy way. He said, you know, people have been telling me that I can't talk anymore. I have to show my travel plans to political advisors, and I'm planning to say something about this on 60 Minutes. And I said, well, why don't you say it to me first?
Right.
And he did. Now the thing that gets missed in some of this is that Jim Hansen alone telling me that someone is trying to muzzle him is not a top of the front page story. It's one man asserting that someone else is. It's a he says she says story because no one in the White House told him this directly. He was told by career public affairs people at NASA that they had been told that there would be dire consequences if he blah blah blah. So I had to nail down all those other aspects of it, and remarkably, I got some people that mid-level kind of person in an agency like NASA who never goes on the record. In this case, you know, Jim has been very gutsy and courageous and you know, willing to step out. But it was actually, frankly, I think Leslie McCarthy, who's a mid-level career public affairs officer and was willing to stick her neck out and say on the record, she was the one who confirmed the things that he said to me indirectly. And so really the story got its strength from her. And that's what made it lead a Sunday paper, as opposed to being sort of a smaller story. And in the end, that piece of all the news that happened in 2006, that was the most read online in the New York Times. That was the single read story in our newspaper.
So do you think the political battles about global warming and, for example, the issue of contrarianism, do you think they have hyped the interest in global warming? And I mean, the fact that you identify that piece as opposed to some of the ones describing the science as the most read piece, that would seem to suggest that. Certainly, I know when we hosted Hansen here, my sense in talking to people in the audience and looking out of the audience was a lot of them were there because of that fight, and they identified Jim as essentially a hero for standing up to the Bush administration.
Well, I would love to think that the science alone could compel our attention on this issue as a society. But some part of me knows that it can't. In fact, one of the most wistful senses I've got about this problem was with an interview I recently did with Ralph Cicerone, the president of the National Academy of Sciences, for a little piece that ran in our Week in Review section a few weeks ago, right after one of the IPCC reports came out. And he said there's something like, I would love to think that an incremental building body of knowledge would be sufficient to drive change on these issues. But as we all know, this is the ultimate slow drip. For all the talk of catastrophe and real-time unraveling of the climate system, this is something that will unfold over generations. And as Sir Nicholas Stern said in one speech that I cited in the story, this really is a problem where the sting is in the tail. The worst outcomes by far face our grandchildren's children, much more than ourselves. So that's why it's still mainly the politics that triggers public attention on this.
Yeah.
And I think there's one problem that comes with that. That also perpetuates this sense of the issue being mainly political. A lot of middle Americans I talk to and I get emails from still have the feeling this is just another he says, she says argument, instead of understanding it for what it is, which is a very, where there's a big body of science in the middle that really is not in debate at all. So every time I write a front page story on the politics of it, I kind of actually am frustrated, because I don't think that, you know, in the political realm, it serves someone's purpose, but usually it serves the purpose of people who are at the edges of things, and that's kind of unfortunate to me. And actually, that's one reason I wrote my new book on climate, the North Pole book, for children. Because one thing I've learned, covering this for a long time, is that adults largely already have their frame, their sort of ideological and educational frame as they approach the issue. And new knowledge is not likely to change them from push them out of the silo, an intellectual silo. And whereas, and this is a long-term issue, so I'm going to work on the next for the current generation.
It's interesting, you brought up this issue of kind of the personality, because we had an interesting dinner and discussion before the last event in the series, which is Elizabeth Colbert, and Forrest Sawyer, who was an anchor for NBC at one point, attended that event. He made the remark, I actually posed the question, why is it that the media, especially the television media, will give such intense discussion to the political aspects and less so to the actual science? And he said the problem is they're junkies. I mean, basically, it's the personalities they're fascinated by, and much less so the science. But anyway, to move on from this question, I wanted to touch on a couple other things. Just checking time here. I'm interested in asking you, Andy, again, given the long coverage, the long time you spent covering the issue, I'm interested in hearing how your own views of this issue of change. For example, just on the first of this year, you had a piece in the Times called A New Middle Stance Emerges in the Debate Over Climate. And actually, there's this blog, Real Climate, and my colleagues, we read this quite often and study it, and your piece was actually discussed quite heavily there. Some people were critical of its tone in that it seemed to be not quite quantarian, but perhaps a little bit more cautionary about the need for action. Other people liked its middle ground. In fact, I recall that when looking at the blog under Real Climate, you actually responded to some of the comments yourself. So if you could, you know, give us both a sense of how your views have changed and also how you see these blogs playing out in terms of, you know, compared to the print media and in the discussion of these kinds of issues. That was a lot of questions, sorry.
Yeah, no, but I get it. Can you hear me okay? By the way, you're coming to me a little bit choppy, but I got the gist of it. And by the way, I do apologize for not being there on purpose. I mean in person, but I just calculated I've saved 2.5 tons of carbon dioxide.
We appreciate that.
So that's my contribution to the climate system. Now, getting back to the questions, I guess that piece, I've done two pieces in the last year that kind of try to peel back from the very stark conveyance of this issue as a real-time disaster that's happening now, that is changing our world now in ways that are profound, and that's the reason we need to act aggressively now to fix the problem. And that is not the understanding of this issue that I get from the scientists I've been talking to for more than 20 years on the issue. It's not something we're going to fix, for one thing, because there is no perfect climate. No one on Earth will ever agree on a setting for the thermostat of planet Earth. People in Siberia and people in French Polynesia are always going to have a different sense of what is a good climate. And this idea that we can engineer either with cutting emissions or some, you know, big gee whiz science, some idealized path is probably not realistic. The world is too variegated. There are countries with so many different interests, self-interest, those that sit on huge heaps of coal and those that don't, and those that have coastlines and those that don't, that the idea of presenting this as a crisis that can be fixed or like a fire that we can put out, I think doesn't really hold. And what I was trying to convey, both in the story last year called Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet, and in the one this year, January 1st, which is in our Energy Challenge series, Right. is the body of evidence that's in the middle of this highly charged discourse that most people still see. You know, if you're sort of embedded in grist land, you know, most of us who are at your session there, or people I know, have a decent sense of the science and all this stuff. But the average American still has kind of the Larry King view of global warming. And the King, I don't know if anyone saw there recently,
I did see it.
Did a night on this. And his version of the discourse on global warming was to have Richard Lindzen from MIT debating Bill Nye, the science guy.
Right, exactly.
And that really says it all. So what I was trying to do is cut through all that crap and just say, here are the things that we know profoundly, that everyone agrees on, that are not in dispute. And it's basically pretty powerful stuff already. More CO2, warmer world, less ice, higher seas, and in all of that, a lot of changes in climate patterns that have been the norm for throughout most of human history. The thing that has gotten so much attention lately isn't that. It's Hurricane Katrina is our fault. It's polar bears are going extinct. It's the Atlantic is going to shut down and freeze Europe. And those issues are highly uncertain, laden with questions. There's legitimate debate. It's not about the contrarians versus believers. On all the points that matter to society, we don't have a clear body of science. There's still legitimate intellectual discourse and many questions to answer. And what I was trying to say is that's all a distraction from the very powerful things that we already know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those are...
Oh, and on the blogs. Quick follow-up on the
sure.
The blogosphere. I think it's a great thing. Real Climate is a very useful entity. I've quoted it now when I wrote about Al Gore's movie to sort of synthesize what a lot of scientists think. I quoted the review on realclimate.org. There's a brand new one that the American Meteorological Society is running called Climatepolicy.org, which is just sort of newborn. I don't visit it regularly, so, but I have a feeling that's going to be a useful one as well.
Okay, I think we're essentially out of time, but I'll just close by just, I think I mentioned this to you yesterday in email, but you had the Times had a piece yesterday about a new poll that said that, you know, the majority of Americans now see a threat, a real threat in global warming. So somehow that message has gotten through. You know, the other thing that I took from this piece is that there's still a lot of hesitation about actually paying for any changes. So it seems like...
Well, I have a piece that's up online right now, and it'll be in tomorrow's Week in Review section on the whole carbon neutral movement. And this is the idea that you kind of buy your way out of your consumerism,
right,
by sort of
exactly
purchasing someone else's emissions reductions while you fly cross country and drive a big car and live in a big house. And the piece basically says, there's been a lot of coverage of this the last few weeks, that is all a distraction from the heavy lifting that will need to happen to have a stable climate by the end of the century or beyond. And this isn't kind of something you can do and still sort of live the 20th century lifestyle we've all become so attuned to. That has to be much more front and center, that for the rest of the century, energy decisions increasingly will have a climate component in terms of how you make that decision. And if that isn't the case, then we're in for a lot of change on planet Earth.
That's a great note to end it on. Thank you so much, Andy Revkin of the New York Times. And
Well, thanks for having me out there. I love California.
Andy,
I love Santa Barbara.
I think we're going to try to just take a couple questions if there are any in the audience.
Sure.
Hopefully. Yeah, let's see if you can hear them. If not, I'll repeat them.
Okay.
Would it be useful to start using the concept or idea of global heating in place of global warming? Heating seems too pleasant Hawaiian holidays oriented. What are we complaining about? Heating is something, except in specific ways, we're not as much in favor of as a concept or a word, just because of the emotional meaning.
Could you hear that?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. The semantics, the language counts a lot. And when I interviewed James Lovelock last year, a few months ago, he's a strong proponent. In fact, in his book, Revenge of Gaia, he doesn't use the phrase global warming at all. He only talks about global heating. I encourage you, anyone who's interested, to go. There's a website, globalheating.org, that a scientist whose name I forgot set up to explain how, even in terms of basic thermodynamics, that's a much more simple way to go at it. Because the heating from an energy imbalance of the system, which is what exists now, is totally indisputable. It's a function of basic, again, thermodynamics. Whereas global warming, how the climate system responds to the heat that's building up, is a much more complicated question. So global heating, probably a good idea.
Okay. Maybe we have time for one more, Ron. Let's see, how about...
There we go. You speak to the middle America who corresponds with you and still thinks it's a she says, and it's clearly a political issue if we need governmental action. What information would be required to move that middle America to make this a primary, if not the primary, issue in the 08 elections?
Did you catch that, Andy?
Yeah, it got cut off a little bit at the end. I see no way that this will be the primary issue in the next presidential campaign, unless we have a hurricane season from hell. Hold on, my computer just went dark.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll...
I'm back.
Oh, sorry, we lost you. That's...
Yeah, I that was weird. I think my computer decided to go to sleep for a second. What does Middle America need to understand? I think Steve Schneider, of all the people I've talked to, and it's, I don't know how many there have been, Rob Lempert, Steve Schneider, Mike Schlesinger, sometimes depending on what day you talk to him, will talk of this as a risk management enterprise. It's similar to things we do every day in our lives. And somehow, if there's a way to make the connection between the daily norm in human life of managing risks and translating that to the global scale, I think we can there can be some change. Steve does this classic thing every time he speaks to a big audience where he asks, maybe I'll ask this right now, how many people in the audience have had a fire in your house? Tell me how many hands go up. Significant
fire. How many people have had a fire? I'd say about 5 or 6.
How many homeowners in the audience have fire insurance?
Well, I think just about, I'm assuming the rest of you aren't homeowners, but most people put their hands up.
Yeah, sure. You get the idea. We don't buy fire insurance or homeowners insurance because we know the house is going to burn down. We don't know the details. We don't know the day the house is going to have a fire. And in the same case here, we don't know. It could be 3 degrees of warming. It could be 8 degrees of warming in 100 years. It could be 10 or 12. And if we don't start investing in an insurance policy that limits impacts and also limits the long-range risk by changing that trajectory of emissions, then we can only be blamed later by our successors for the heavy costs that they may have to shoulder at that time. Now, translating the norm of human behavior on the daily scale to that scale of time and space is a huge leap.
It's a huge challenge.
But I do think we're at this amazing moment. We're in an amazing moment in human history right now, where our potency, our ability to influence the planet, is in a race with our self-awareness afforded by science that, hey, guess what? We are influencing the planet in largely irreversible ways. And so it's this race between self-awareness and potency. It doesn't surprise me now that it's taking a long time for this to sink in a way that's meaningful. Obviously, it's a hot issue right now, but by meaningful, I mean deciding as a person to drive less, deciding to make this an issue you take to the ballot box, deciding to change the way your house works, deciding to make it a priority when you talk to your local politicians, that's taken time and it will take more time. And again, that's why I'm working this issue in several generations at once. I have a piece that I've just written for AARP magazine coming out in June, making sense of global warming and trying to make these points about limiting risk. So, you know, I'm writing for grandparents, grandchildren, and grown-ups in nytimes.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for those comments, Andy, and we really appreciate you joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you again.
My name is Cecilia. I'm a senior here at UCSB, and I'm reporting on my senior thesis, which I'm halfway through right now. And the original question I started out with was, do some newspapers report on more important environmental issues than others? And to give you a sense of what I mean by this, if you were to type in the words climate change, wildlife, and pollution into LexisNexis, online database of newspapers, and search the front page of the New York Times and The Independent, which is a well-respected British newspaper, the New York Times would give you, with energy tax bonanza, Wyoming schools enjoy windfall. Forget the bucking bronco. A clattering cash register has become the more apt symbol of Wyoming in the energy rush. While the Independent would give you something like this. Death of the world's rivers. Disaster warning from the United Nations as investigation reveals half the planet's 500 biggest rivers are seriously depleted or polluted. So there's really a greater global scale and sense of consequence in this title versus the last. So when trying to figure out how was I empirically going to decide what is important and what's not, I went to hazard assessment, particularly this article, The Nature of Technological Hazard, which was published in Science 1983. And the key point of the quote below is that it's to simplify the analysis and management of those hazards by a lay audience because policies governing various types of hazards are determined to a large extent by people who are not scientists or hazard assessment experts. So Slovic and Cates et al. Designed a really easy to understand schemata of different types of hazards and how to judge them. So you can see spatial extent, the maximum area over which a hazard might occur, concentration, the released material comparison to the natural background, and then more of the familiar things that we're used to, human death and non-human mortality, plants and animals. And so to this, we added a final category after the biological consequences, which we termed management, which is really the end goal of a hazard assessment. And we added economic costs, loss of money, jobs, work hours, resources, and mentions of solutions, money saved, water saved, anything like that. And then on top of this sort of coding for what sort of information about hazards was appearing in the newspapers, we also overlaid specific versus non-specific, and I'll get to that later. Okay, so we chose the United States and the United Kingdom because although they have very similar journalistic standards, fairness and balance, they have really vastly different environmental standards. Climate Change Performance Index ranked the United Kingdom as second and the United States as 53rd out of 56 countries. Or Yale's Environmental Performance Index ranked the UK as 5th and the US as 28th. So then we chose the New York Times, the pretty much de facto national newspaper, and the Independent, a really well-trusted, obviously politically independent newspaper. And even though the circulation for the Independent is 200,000 copies, that's actually not too bad for Britain. Okay, so I'll try to keep the methodology really brief, but the really important part was that in the literature review, there's really no discussion about what is environmental or what is an environmental issue. So we started off with this really broad framework of what an environmental issue is that sort of echoed David Jensen's sort of like cyclical idea of, you know, human to nature, nature to human. And we sat down and we started reading newspapers. And we were really surprised by how limited the scope was for the types of environmental issues that were being reported on. It was, you know, fish stocks are collapsing and there's too much mercury in our food and so on. So we just developed a keyword list, things like wildlife, climate change, to search through LexisNexis, which is a pretty well-trusted, pretty the most comprehensive database of newspapers. So yeah, I'll just kind of skip over this part. These are the preliminary results. There's still a second data set to go through, but the Independent had 113 articles, which is 50% more than the Times, with only 74 articles that were environmental. But despite that, the average word count was really very close to the same. Okay, so to give you an example of the titles that we would find, environmental activists arrested, power plants ranked high on pollution list, Branson pledges billions to help develop clean fuels, and you can see that they're in various sections of the newspaper. Or from the Independent, UK government on collision course with Brussels over carbon trading, a good neighbor and green friend, Tesco, kind of like our Walmart, goes after hearts as well as wallets, and so on. Okay, so here's where it gets interesting. So we took all of these mentions of the hazards that were happening, and we measured them as a percent of the total, because the New York Times had than the Independent. And you can see that the New York Times really talks a lot about solutions and costs, and really almost nothing about the mortality of animal life or plant life. And in the other categories, they're pretty comparable. The Independent is a lot, has significantly more for concentration because of their really intent focus on global warming. So a lot of discussion about carbon emissions. So to give you an example of what sort of things we would code for would be like mercury hazard in wooded areas of New York and throughout the northeastern United States. So it's identifying the actual maximum extent of the area where this hazard is occurring, or all 178 woodland birds tested last year had unusual high levels of mercury. Okay, and examples from The Independent. Mass bird kills with more than 5,000 oil-covered guillemots. All great ape species face a high risk of extinction within the next 50 years. Or economic costs. Projected demise of the Mediterranean cork oak forest will result in the loss of 62,000 jobs. Okay, so once we had all of this data about what sort of information the newspapers were really putting in, we could categorize it based on specific and non-specific. So if the article said, you know, this standard is going to prevent 3,000 premature deaths, 3,000 is a concrete number, versus, you know, something could result in tens of thousands of deaths. Well, that's a pretty significant range, and it's just described in words, not numerals. And so when we sorted the data through this way, we found that they were actually very similar, 50% specific, 50% non-specific for both Independent and New York Times. And that was actually really surprising, mostly just because you expect literature for a non-science audience to be very general. So this was actually encouraging. So placement of the articles is not super important. Okay, so then here's where it really gets interesting. Once we have those specific results for any particular hazard category, what we can do is we can average them up and compare them for the two newspapers. So, I mean, keep in mind that this is an extremely small sample size, and so this is just an example. But so the New York Times has, okay, a leak at a chemical plant kills 2,500 people, bird flu has killed 200, and The Independent has, you know, 31 plant workers killed and 15,000 unexpected deaths due to rising temperature. So then, you can average them out and compare them, and you can see that, wow, The Independent, when it's going to talk about an event, it's going to talk about something with an average of 3,500 deaths, and the New York Times is going to talk about something with like 7,500 deaths, 750 deaths, sorry. And really, the scope of The Independent seems to be on a greater scale than the New York Times. Obviously, this is just an example because the data set would have to be actually enormous. But that's where I'm hoping this will go. And if you know, cross my fingers, this ever gets published, I would really hope that this is something that is expanded on. So the implications from the preliminary results that we have are that the US is really pragmatic and business-oriented, as we saw by the discussion of costs and the focus on solutions, which is encouraging. And Europe is very compassionate. There were a lot of discussion about like how the birds and the plants are being killed and so on, which is important, but more importantly, we see that the quality of the environmental reporting seems to be the same across the country, across countries, even though the quantity seems to be lacking in the New York Times. And I personally was very surprised by this. I thought the New York Times was going to be swamped by The Independent, but it really seems to be very adequate. And these results can inform potential media consumers. So let's say there's a high school, and they're choosing which newspaper to order to have their students read. Well, the New York Times is pretty good, you know, I mean, from what we can see. And this sort of takes us to what could be studied next. Like, well, obviously the New York Times is the newspaper of record, but what would we find in local or regional or chain newspapers?
A big part of what we want to do here, too, is have a fairly large period of time for some interaction with the audience in a more panel form. But we each were asked to give a few minutes of some perspective on the scientific views in terms of how these issues are portrayed in the media. And so we've taken different approaches, and I think they'll be a little complementary. I'm going to try and give you some overview. What I did was I used this opportunity to go after recent publications on climate change and just use Google News to get a list of hundreds and hundreds of things that have been published in 2007. I just started reading them. And so here's some thoughts. I thought I'd talk about three things, the perspectives that came out of just reading a bunch of these. One is, I think, a big change in the presentation of scientific controversy has happened. Second is, I have to make a plug for the oceans because it's underrepresented. And then third, I want to come back to this issue of scientific controversy and make an observation, I think, about how that the discussion of that is likely to change in a very big way in the coming years. So the first one is that 5 years ago, if we would have done this, most of the comments would have come from the scientists would have been focused on the overemphasis in the press on balance and trying to find someone within the scientific community that's going to have a counter opinion on basically anything that's stated in terms of the presentation of the science. And this is despite the fact that if, you know, there have been a variety of different scientific studies. There's one in 2004 where they synthesized hundreds of scientific articles, and basically this is one of the least controversial issues I can think of in science in terms of a number of the major overall features of human impacts on climate change. And I'll come back to the fact that there's still lots of controversy, but it's not in terms of the fact that humans are very likely playing an important role. And the striking thing from reading well over 100 of these articles published this year is that the shift in emphasis in terms of the scientific dissent has really been dramatic. And in fact, it's to the point now where most of the articles that I was reading dismiss the fact that there's really any important scientific controversy. A really dramatic change in terms of how things are being displayed. And I'll come back to controversy in a second. The second point is that oceans represent over two-thirds of the planet, and if you go do this Google search for news articles that have been published just since January 1st of this year, it's over 30,000 of them on climate change. But a very, very minor fraction even mention anything about the oceans. And so let me make a plug. There's some, and vast majority of the discussion in terms of thinking about oceans totally has to do with sea level rise. Which is an incredibly important issue. And there are a bunch of really interesting ones. My grad students hope that the first one up here is true. But there are some really fascinating things in terms of the issue of more of the planet even becoming an ocean in the coming years. But oceans, of course, play incredibly key roles in what we know about how climate change is operating. And it play both positive and complicating roles. One being that the problem would be far worse in terms of the increases in CO2 in the atmosphere if it weren't for the capacity of the oceans to actually be able to uptake a lot of additional CO2 as a result of the enormous productivity that happens in the real thin skin of the ocean with these microscopic plants. But the second is the one that's really important in terms of the role of oceans. And this is something that Elizabeth Colbert talked about very eloquently, is this issue of the time lag between the response of the climate system and the input of greenhouse gases into the atmospheres that's driven primarily because of the fact it takes so long for the ocean to equilibrate to the new conditions in terms of the heat budget that's been applied. So this is an area that's getting, I think, needs a lot more attention in terms of the critical role that the oceans play. And most of these are really focusing on the terrestrial climates. The last point is I want to come back to this issue of uncertainty. Despite the fact that it was clear that the presentation of the overall uncertainty on is the climate changing and are humans playing some role in this has changed dramatically, there are other really important issues of the way scientific uncertainty, I think, is going to play out And these are very complicated problems in terms of dealing with how climate on a global scale is going to change. If you look at our best abilities to forecast those changes, even over any time scale, decades or centuries, those forecasts can vary enormously because they're largely based upon modeling exercises. And even though the models are getting very sophisticated and able to hopefully more accurately forecast how things are going to change, they can vary dramatically from one to the next. And so let me come back to this issue of the consequences. The other thing that I think has been emerging on the scientific side, and this is definitely true if you think about the oceans, is that one aspect of the uncertainty as we learn more and more, unfortunately, seems to be that the story keeps getting worse, not better. That as we understand the details on the scientific side, the scope of the problem actually is more daunting. This is just as an example on the ocean side. 10 years ago, no one was really thinking that carefully about the consequences of just having this additional CO2 dissolving into the oceans and how it's affecting the pH, the acidity of the oceans. And now that's emerging as an issue that's going to have potentially huge effects in terms of ocean life. The second is, and Jim Richmond put up a couple of examples of this, is that the predictions that come out of these climate change models are really complicated. Jim gave you an example of how you can display this very nicely, and you can see that even with a doubling of CO2 that you get in an overall general warming of the planet, there are places that are predicted to get colder under those kinds of conditions. And yet, if we look at these kinds of model predictions, it's those details that where they still vary from one model to the next. And so the overall patterns may be much more consistent across model runs, but the details don't matter. I mean, they vary, and they can vary dramatically for certain kinds of climate aspects. This is temperature. Here's one for predicted changes and impacts of storms. And why this matters is these details may seem like trivial things, but the details are at the scales of entire nations. And so in terms of thinking about the issues of uncertainty and insurance and how we're going to respond, if we can't forecast these details, and they are actually what's forecasting the responses at the level of entire regions of countries or countries entirety, that's a really serious problem. So let me end to my short little part here and say, you know, how do we need to deal with this? And Andy's interview addressed this, I think, really beautifully. I mean, obviously, we need a lot more research so that we can reduce the uncertainty. But given the fact that the uncertainty is very large and there's going to be a lot of debate in terms of what these predictions are like, what do we do? Do we wait for better predictions before we respond, which is the action that happens in many cases? Or does this make it even more urgent that we take action in a way that is analogous to buying insurance? So, thank you.
I'm going to wait for all three presenters, and then you can ask questions to all three presenters. You'll see they're related.
My name is Catherine Gauthier. I'm a professor in the geography department. And I opted for a focused presentation because we have a few minutes only, and decided to talk about how we can help people, the public, and our students understand this complicated issue of global warming and the science that is beneath it, in the midst of a new media culture which has so many capabilities, which offers so many capabilities to us. Global warming is a quite complex science. You know, like any most science are complex. The problem is it has much social relevance, and people all over the world are affected by global warming and climate change. So therefore, there's a need to understand it at some level, and therefore there's a need to have some scientific literacy to understand it. It's also a science in the making, in the sense that we don't have definitive answers for many of the questions that are being asked. So there are debates going on, there are healthy debates, and that are often used and misused. And because it's complex, we need time to explain it. And the 2-minute time slots that we have often when we are talking to the media are not sufficient to explain the complexity and the intricacies that exist. There is much information available on, for instance, on the internet. And one of the questions that is starting to rise now is, what is the quality? How can we evaluate what is out there? And it takes time to explain, to evaluate what is available and explain the not only the complexity, but the mistakes that are, the incorrect explanation that are offered, sometimes purposely, sometimes not purposely. And that's pretty much what I decided to do today, is to take you through one particular element that has been put together, that has been brought to my attention by students of mine, were telling me that after taking my class, they were still unable to look at some of the elements that were available on a certain video that I will be showing you and make sense of it, because it disagreed with what I was telling them in my class. So what I've decided to use is to analyze briefly two media that are pretty common now. One we have heard from, the Real Climate Blog, which is a community site put together by working climatologists for the public and for journalists. It's a certain, relatively, it's a level that is not understandable by everybody, but it's one that is there to help frame and put a context to the developing stories. The other one is offered by YouTube, and you may have heard of YouTube, which is a video sharing website where people can upload, view, and share video clips. So the video that I decided to look at is called The Great Global Warming Swindle. It's put together by the British TV Channel 4 program. And basically, it's presented as an alternative to global warming, and it's an antidote to an inconvenient truth from Vice President Al Gore. So let me give you a little flavor of what this video is about. And you will see that it starts being quite dramatic.
Imagine that we live in an age of reason.
And presents talking heads, scientists, experts, the well-known contrarians, but still, some of them are well-known.
There's no direct evidence scientists. Which links 20th century global warming to anthropogenic greenhouse gases.
We're just being told lies. That's what it comes down to.
You can't say that CO2 will drive climate. It certainly never did in the past.
If the CO2 increases in the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas, then the temperature will go up. But the ice core record shows exactly the opposite. So the fundamental assumption, the most fundamental assumption of the whole theory of climate change due to humans is shown to be wrong.
It's the whole thing.
So, why are we paying so much attention is because some well-known scientists are part of it. And, this video presents some facts, but it presents a mix of scientific fact and opinion. And it's really hard for people who are not aware to differentiate what is fact and what is science. And, one of the main statements they make is that that the temperature and carbon dioxide correlation that is found in the ice core, which is talked about in Al Gore movie, as you probably have seen, is not as simple. As
the greenhouse effect works like this. The sun sends its heat down to Earth. If it weren't for greenhouse gases, this solar radiation would... Professor Clark and others have indeed discovered, as Al Gore says, a link between carbon dioxide and temperature. But what Al Gore doesn't say is that the link is the wrong way round.
So here we're looking at the ice core record from Vostok. And in the red, we see temperature going up from early time to later time at a very key interval when we came out of a glaciation. And we see the temperature going up, and then we see the CO2 coming up. CO2 lags behind that increase. It's got an 800-year lag. So temperature is leading CO2 by 800 years.
There have now been several major...
Okay, so this is a fact. This is a fact that is not a simple fact in the sense that is not simply understood, that the fact that it's not what we would expect, that carbon dioxide start increasing first and then temperature follows, temperature increases first. Now, it's very well understood by the scientific community, but the explanation is quite complex. It's the presence of a temperature carbon dioxide feedback, which as the temperature warms up, more carbon dioxide gets emitted, and as more carbon dioxide is emitted, the temperature increases. So it requires the understanding, a certain level of understanding to explain, and often when we present things, we have to simplify the elements, and which is one of the big difficulty that exists in presenting a complex topic, which is how far do we have to simplify, and when we simplify, we bring in some elements that are not totally correct. Okay, the second thing, which is what Andrew Refkin was telling us we absolutely know, which is that carbon dioxide is responsible for temperature increase. But as we saw, it is true and not true at the same time. It's part of the story. But in this movie, they are telling us, and this is an argument that is being used quite a lot in the contrarian world, is that if it's not carbon dioxide that is responsible for climate change, what is it? And in this case, they are suggesting that it's the sun, that the sun is responsible for climate change. And it's, again, through a complex series of complex processes where the cosmic rays that are emitted by the sun through when sunspots are active are interacting with clouds, which then reduce if there is more cloud, or increase if there is less cloud, the radiation arriving at the surface, and therefore the temperature change. So again, here, this is a possible mechanism, but they are not showing the entire story, and the scientific evidence, which is now clearly proven, is that although this correlation between cosmic rays and temperature exists, and it may have some impact, the relationship falls apart after the 1990s because carbon dioxide has taken over the process. So again, what I'm doing here is kind of going through this dissection of a movie, which is very well done and presented by scientists with a mixture of facts and opinions, which is quite difficult to understand for the general public, even for those who have a certain level of education. So I probably don't how much time. Okay, I just want to just bring out some conclusion. So here I've listed a few tactics that I used in this movie, but I would like to see, you know, how can we do better? How can we make better use of the media as educators, particularly? And one of the issues that interests me personally is that of educating and communicating about climate change, about the basic climate change science. But the question that I'm always confronted with is, how far do we have to go? How much do the students have to know? How much does the public has to know to really understand what is happening? So improving scientific literacy is important, but is this the only thing? The second part is, how can we present the issue to the public, in this case, which are complex and sometimes contentious, in a way that makes them personally relevant to our audience? So I think one of the approach I would suggest is that, you know, first as a group, a collective group of scientists and educators, we get together and agree on, you know, how we can pass this information in simple bits. We heard from our colleagues at the LA Times that we have to translate what we do in simple terms. And I think this is something which is difficult for us to do. And I think this is something where we should make an effort.
Thank you.
I don't have a PowerPoint, so you'll just have to look at me, I guess, and instead of the screen. I'm going to make what appears to be a criticism of the media, but really the media have a a very tough job, and the fact that they may not have gotten it perfect really is not, I think it shouldn't be interpreted as a criticism, but rather a suggestion as to perhaps how it things could be improved. The two points that I'd like to talk about are the treatment of scientific uncertainty in the media, and this has already been touched on by both of the speakers, and the treatment of the economics of environmental problems, specifically climate change, or as Andy Revkin put it, I think much better, the risk management dimensions of the problem. So first, let's talk about the uncertainty very briefly. And there's an example that really sticks in my mind. I was at a meeting in Beijing about a year ago, and that's the only time I watch CNN. And at the same time, a article had come out about the glaciers in Greenland. Many of you may recall that about a year ago, several articles coming out about the more rapid melting of those glaciers. So the reporting from CNN had a very careful interview with the author of one of the articles, and then they followed this up with an interview with a guy from the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank in Washington, which is unabashedly has an agenda to pursue. And this was viewed as by CNN as the way to report an article on a scientific result. You interview the author, and then you find somebody who disagrees with them, or at least has a position to push that is contrary to that, and that's the nature of the reporting. And I think that's a fundamental problem with the treatment of uncertainty by the media, particularly with regard to climate change, but not necessarily confined to that. And one thing I think is important to make a distinction about, and that's the distinction between uncertainty and controversy, or uncertainty and disagreement. You can have a scientific result that the glaciers are melting at a certain rate, and there can be uncertainty about the exact magnitude of that rate. Maybe it's quite a bit higher, maybe it's quite a bit lower. And you can have 100% unanimity in the scientific community that uncertainty exists. And I think there's often a confusion in the reporting between not being totally sure about the exact magnitude of a particular parameter or result regarding climate change, and there's certainly a lot of uncertainty in it, confusing that with uncertainty about whether there's anything here whatsoever, and trying to help readers sort through those two types of uncertainty, I think, has not been done well in the press. And like I said at the beginning, it's a tough act. It's a tough message to convey, and people have certainly tried it, so it's not really necessarily a damning criticism of the media. It's just that it's a point that's important that has to be driven home a little bit better in the future. The second point regards what I think of as economics of climate change, but I think for many people, thinking of it as risk management is probably a little more intuitive. And that is driving home the concept that there are real resource gains, real economic gains from doing something about an environmental problem. That it's not just a luxury, that it's not just that the bugs and the monies are in better shape. There are real gains to people, economic gains as well as welfare gains associated with avoiding as frequent floods, avoiding more heat waves. You can go down the list of the kinds of tangible consequences that we can talk about avoiding. Translate those into what people can put their hands around. And then, of course, the other side of the coin is helping people realize that there are real resource costs associated with doing something. Often there's a one-sentence mention of these things, but it's very infrequent that one goes very much further under the surface of what really is one of the most fundamental dimensions of the climate change problem, is what can we do about it? What's realistic to do about it? We have a lot of demands on our the resources of our society. How much do we want to put in this? It's a question we have to answer, and we're ill-equipped to do so. So it's important to convey that the costs are significant for climate change, but they're similar to the costs we spend on all sorts of things all the time. If we're looking for a free lunch, well, we don't look for it in other dimensions of our life. Why should we be looking for it here? And the debate that does go on between those claiming that it is essentially a costless undertaking to do something about climate change, and those who are more realistic, often gets swept under the rug. As everybody knows, California is doing something about this, but it tends to be a he says, she says kind of reporting on the cost of doing something rather than an in-depth analysis of the question. And finally, the benefits of reducing climate change, the real benefits to everyday life of people, as well as the more intangible and important things of the oceans and other things that impact us, are not really well reported in the media. So I think getting back to the wrapping this all up and bringing the uncertainty in, it's important. People need to realize that we don't wait until all the uncertainty has disappeared from problems before we take action on them. We don't do that in our everyday life. We recognize that uncertainty is a reality, and we just live with it. We make decisions with that. And climate change is really no different. And conveying this in the press, I think, would be very, very constructive. Thank you.